you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, and I'm very happy to get to tell you that now up at kpecc.org/in-person is your opportunity to reserve space in our virtual Film Week Academy Awards preview. Every year, of course, for two decades plus, we've done the Film Week Academy Awards preview most recent years at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, beautiful historic venue. We, of course, are not going to be able to do that this year, but we're still going to do our Oscar preview show with all of our Film Week critics. The event will be live online Sunday, April 18th at 1 in the afternoon. That's exactly a week before the Oscars are given out and what's supposed to be an in-person event, but we will be doing ours virtually. All you have to do is make your reservation at kpecc.org/in-person. I'm looking forward to our biggest crowd ever since we have no theater capacity limitation that's involved as we do it virtually. Again, Sunday afternoon, April 18th, the Film Week Academy Awards preview. I hope to see you there in virtual space. We turn our attention now to the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer accused in the killing of George Floyd. Killing, of course, about that specific incident, but so much more, as it led to weeks of protests around the country and has led to numerous changes as well socially here in the United States. But now we get to the actual criminal trial of former officer Derek Chauvin. This morning, the judge delayed jury selection at least until tomorrow because there's still an appeals process going on as to whether Mr. Chauvin will be charged with third-degree murder, whether that will be included in the charges or not. Joining us to talk about what we can expect to see from both of the legal teams in this case is Brian Dunn, managing partner at the Cochran Firm, California, the firm, of course, founded by Johnny Cochran, and Brian Dunn, civil rights attorney. Mr. Dunn, thank you very much for being with us. What do you expect to be at the heart of the prosecution case?
Well, thank you so much for having me, Larry. And this is obviously a case that has tentacles, and there's never one sentence that can capture either side's entire burden of proof or what either side wants to hope to achieve. The issue right now that everybody's dealing with is this charge called third-degree murder. And the battle lines are being drawn now because third-degree murder is a lot easier to prove than the other degrees of murder. In Minnesota, they call it second-degree murder. Third-degree murder is defined loosely as unintentional killing of a person, whereas all of the second-degree murder statutes seem to have either an intent requirement or something that is tantamount to an intent requirement because it evidences a depraved heart or a reckless disregard for someone's suffering. The prosecution wants a win. The defense wants a clean sweep. And a lot of times when you're dealing with murder charges, although it may seem counterintuitive, the defense argues for the more severe charge because they know that it's going to be harder to prove. And the prosecution winds up arguing for the less severe charge. In this case, it went all the way up to the Court of Appeals, who said that this is a charge that should be considered, but the judge is still not quite ready to give up his position. And it may be that the Minnesota Supreme Court has the final say here.
And what are the other charges about which there is no dispute that he will definitely be facing, regardless of the third-degree murder charge?
Well, he's going to be facing a second-degree murder charge. You can, as a prosecutor, they can charge many different counts of murder. And sometimes the jury will be instructed as to several counts, and they will deliver a special verdict form that has different categories for each count. So this is going to be a murder charge, whether it has a component of intent or whether it has a component of something that is called depraved heart in Minnesota, or whether it has an unintentional requirement. We're definitely going to see some components of a murder trial here.
We have one man who was killed and yet potentially two charges of murder. How does that work under the law?
Well, the prosecution has several discretionary choices that they can use. And a lot of times the jury will be instructed as to every type of charge that is currently pending. And sometimes they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. And what is going to happen at the end of this trial is the jury is going to be required to answer a series of questions. And they're not going to be clearly delineated in a way that we may be talking, or the way that a lawyer may be talking. It's exclusively up to the judge as to how that verdict form is going to be organized. And there are many avenues through which the prosecution can have almost two bites at the apple, but they can have alternative theories that both go to the jury. That's the point. And the concept of double jeopardy and being charged successively is not going to come into play here, because this is his trial. And the concept is that there's only going to be one day in court. So it's going to be up to some rulings and the discretion of the prosecutors as to exactly what charges are going to get before the jury when this is all said and done, which frankly, Larry, could be several months down the road.
Yeah, I was going to say, you were using one day in court figuratively, I know, because this trial is going to be extensive. And to that point, what sorts of witnesses and evidence do we anticipate will be introduced over this extensive period of time?
Well, that's a great question, Larry. And if I'm on the defense, I'm going to be trying to say that this man was just doing his job. As difficult as it may seem, people have a lot of misconceptions about what police really do based on things that they see in movies and things that they see on TV. And if I'm the defense, I'm going to say this is a very difficult job and things don't always turn out in a way that would support a Hollywood ending. There are some pretty compelling factual conclusions that can be drawn from some of the policies that the Minnesota Police Department had with regard to this particular tactical maneuver. They can argue that he was doing what he was trained, or they can argue that if he wasn't, this is something that shouldn't be considered on the level of an intent to kill, more a mistake. And the prosecution has the burden to prove every charge and every element of every charge beyond a reasonable doubt. And one of the most effective ways that a defense attorney in this case could create reasonable doubt is right along that issue we're talking about, Larry, which is state of mind. He may have used excessive force, but he did not intend to kill this man. He may have seen a situation and overreacted to it, but he didn't intend to kill this man. And you're going to have probably some testimony regarding his health condition. That's going to go both ways by expert witnesses. You're probably going to have a lot of testimony concerning drugs that were in his system or not in his system, and how those may have affected his last moments of life. But I can tell you that it's going to be very long and very drawn out for two reasons, Larry. Number one, I don't think this officer is going to plead to anything. That's what I think. And number two, everyone is watching. And because everyone is watching, we saw this during the OJ trial. I was actually in the office when this was happening. Things that would normally take 15 minutes can take an entire afternoon, because everyone wants to understand that they're playing before a national audience. And there are pros and cons to that, but strategically it does without fail draw everything out much longer than it normally would be drawn out.
We're talking with Brian Dunn, civil rights attorney and managing partner at the Cochran Firm, California. He specializes in police misconduct cases. Also with us is Chicago-based defense attorney and former police officer Daniel Herbert. He actually represented ex-officer Jason Van Dyke, who shot and killed 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. McDonald was shot by the officer 16 times and was convicted of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm. That trial took place just over 2 years ago. Mr. Herbert, thank you very much for being with us. Let's talk about the extremely painful video of George Floyd and his death. That has such emotional power with everybody who has seen that. How does that factor into the jury's decision?
Well, Larry, it's critical. Video is a very powerful, influential piece of evidence. In this case, the prosecutors are going to rely heavily on that video, and I would assume show it as many times as possible. It's once that video is played, although I would suspect that most of the jurors will have already seen that video. Once it's played, the reality is that the burden then shifts to the defendant to prove his innocence. And I think that's what's going to have to be done in this case.
Do you think Mr. Chauvin is going to be taking the stand and offering his interpretation of what's on that video?
You know, I obviously don't know Mr. Chauvin, and I don't know what the strategy is for his lawyers, but I've represented a lot of police officers in use of force cases. And when there is a video that is pretty compelling, my thought process is that it is almost imperative that the defendant take the witness stand. And, you know, I'm a former prosecutor, believe me, that I recognize that comes with some perils. But at the end of the day, the defendant has to get up and explain what was going on in their head at the time they were committing these acts. And sometimes, you know, a defendant can be very charming and persuasive. And it's just, you know, the prosecutors are going to be prepared to pounce on the defense when he takes a stand. But at the end of the day, it is in these type of cases, in my opinion, it's a necessity.
If you were in this defending in this case, do you think you would explicitly bring up potential for unrest, perhaps even in closing arguments, to sort of address that elephant in the room and jurors who might be concerned that if there is any acquittal on any of these counts, it could lead to unrest?
You know, unfortunately, that is something that you have to address. I would do most of my addressing that issue in voir dire to see what type of fortitude these jurors have, what type of independence and conviction they would have in the jury room. But you have to address this. And the way I would address it is that we understand that your job is difficult here, but you swore an oath to judge this case fairly and to presume the innocence of the defendant. And that is your duty in this case. And despite the public pressure to convict, you have to follow the law here. You have to give the jurors an out for voting not to convict in this case, because by far the simplest decision for any juror in this case would be to convict.
Mr. Herbert, on the expert testimony that we might see, will it be challenging for the defense to find experts to come in and interpret that video and find that it conforms with acceptable police practices? I mean, this is something that's been seen by law enforcement, you know, rank and file officers, and by experts who have almost universally, that I've seen, condemned what former Officer Chauvin did, as seen on that video. So is that going to be a challenge to get someone who's going to say that what Chauvin did was in any way defensible?
Well, it is a challenge. Experts, they're in the business field, and they realize that testifying on behalf of a very, very unpopular defendant, such as Mr. Chauvin in this case, can certainly have some negative business implications. But in this case, they will find an expert, and there's certainly some factors that the expert can hang their hat on to provide this testimony. And, you know, one of them certainly would be the police department's training and their policies, which allowed for this type of subduing of an individual. So it's a difficult case. And the video in this case, as bad as it is, there are some potential defenses that I have found in that video. And, you know, when an officer shoots an individual and kills him, it's very difficult to argue the causation prong. But in this case, what the video does not show, it doesn't show the level of force that was being placed on Mr. Floyd by Chauvin. And, you know, the defense is certainly going to argue that the fact that Mr. Floyd was able to talk and plead and cry out for help, as difficult as that sounds, it certainly is a factor to show that the level of force was not substantial, and more importantly, that it did not cause a death in this case, which I think is going to be the position that they're going to try and attack the most.
So that I assume then is going to rely on dueling interpretations from autopsies of Mr. Floyd?
Yeah, it'll be a battle of the experts here. The state will have one and the defense will have one. And, you know, they're going to, here, the state is required to prove that that Mr. Chauvin caused the death of Mr. Floyd. And in for the jury instruction that my colleague, Mr. Dunn, spoke about, it is critical as far as how these instructions are worded. But, you know, cause, it means a substantial causal factor in causing the death. And there may be other causes, but at the end of the day, if it's a substantial causal factor in this case, then the jury is going to be led to believe, or is going to be more influenced to vote to convict.
Daniel Herbert joining us, a Chicago-based defense attorney, former police officer himself. Brian Dunn, civil rights attorney, managing partner at the Cochran Firm, California. Mr. Dunn, anything that Mr. Herbert has said that you see differently, you think might play out differently?
I agree with pretty much everything Mr. Herbert said wholeheartedly. This is going to be a case that is going to be a battle on many different levels. I think that the one thing that I may disagree with has to do with Mr. Herbert. I made a comment to the effect of you can't see the level of force, or you can't see the amount of force that's being used in the video. And while that is technically correct from the perspective of a lawyer, from the perspective of a layperson, that is something a lot of people would have a hard time digesting, because it does very clearly show his knee is pressed against his neck. It's pressed downward. And whether it's pressed to a certain extent downward or a lesser extent downward, the fact that it's pressed downward and he appears to be in a very uncomfortable situation, that's going to be enough for a lot of people to have the requisite amount of force that's there. But we can't get away from the most important point, I think, that Mr. Herbert recognized, which is that this is going to be, the battle lines are going to be drawn on what the elements of these charges are. And the most critical one is going to concern intent. And these are some of the really deep issues about what happens in the field. As Mr. Herbert correctly pointed out, if it's a shooting, you've got a very distinct insular event. It's got a beginning, it's got an ending. You never are going to be subject to wondering how the person died. But in a case like this, like many in custody deaths, like many suicides that may or not be suicides in jails, there are going to be many experts on many different disciplines that are going to literally talk about every single component of this, from did he have a pre-existing health condition? Was his condition exacerbated by adrenaline, by drugs? Was his condition such that any type of aggressive arrest might have caused a critical medical event? And you're really going to see people on both sides. And I don't think that it's going to be hard for the defense to find an expert, because this is the type of case that can make someone famous. And, you know, a lot of these folks want to be seen. That doesn't necessarily bode, that doesn't necessarily have a positive correlation with the integrity of their opinions, but yeah, it is reality.
All right. Mr. Dunn, thank you so much. Good to have you with us today on Air Talk. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Larry.
From the Cochran Firm, California, he's managing partner, civil rights attorney Brian Dunn. And my thanks to Chicago-based defense attorney Daniel Herbert, former police officer. He represented ex-officer Jason Van Dyke, who was convicted of killing 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. The officer shot him 16 times. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, 1 minute on Air Talk, we'll speak with the outgoing mayor of Compton, Asia Brown. She served 2 terms in office. She'll continue in office until this summer. She's decided not to seek re-election. We'll talk with her about what her plans are and what she's seen in her city over the course of these past 8 years. Back in 1 minute.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.